is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KABU on June 22nd and 23rd for our live broadcast for Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival. We'll start the broadcast from King School Park and Good in the Hood Saturday at 2 p.m. Bands include the Elliot Young Band, Hot Tea Cold, Ronnie Wright, Cool Breeze, and more. Sunday, we'll start the broadcast at noon and we'll feature Funky Fusion featuring Amanda Ryan, the Norman Sylvester Band, Soul Vaccination, and more. Again, that's Good in the Hood, a multicultural music, arts, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experiences to strengthen unity in the community. The broadcast will be Saturday, June 22nd from 2 to 10 p.m. and Sunday, June 23rd from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up in the KABU Evening News, 2 days of record-shattering, sweltering heat in cities all across Oregon.
Two big names in the Trump administration, one stepping down from the job, the other told she should.
And in international news, a KABU News commentary about the Julius Assange WikiLeaks case.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, June 13th, 2019. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Annette Newell. Well, it's in the record books now. A second day of record-shattering heat scorched the Portland metro area Wednesday as several areas sweltered into the high 90s. The National Weather Service says Portland reached 97 degrees, breaking a record of 93 set back in 2002. Eugene shattered its previous heat record by 10 degrees, hitting 99. Salem broke its record by a degree at 94 degrees. Hillsborough reached 97, breaking a 1932 record of 94. McMinnville broke an almost century-old record, hitting 96. And Troutdale reached 97 degrees, breaking a 1986 record of 94. And the National Weather Service predicts, fortunately, we've got some cooler weather for the rest of this week with temperatures in the 80s.
Pacific Power predicts that this year's wildfire season will bring more frequent and intense fires throughout the West. The company's Scott Bolton says it's already gearing up with safety measures, trying to reduce the wildfire risks and improve emergency response plans. Pacific Power says it's working with local emergency services agencies, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and community leaders across Oregon. For areas at a higher risk of fast-spreading wildfires, it's starting a new fire prevention measure called a public safety power shutoff. The idea is to help keep people and communities in high-risk areas safe by proactively shutting off power during extreme and dangerous weather conditions that can result in catastrophic wildfires. Pacific Power says it would only use it as a last resort to help ensure customer and community safety. The company's also launching a public wildfire education and outreach campaign starting June 24th to share wildfire safety and prevention tips and to inform customers about the public safety power shutoff measure. This will include workshops for communities in high-risk areas. Find out more by going to pacificpower.net/wildfire safety.
The Democratic National Committee has announced that Washington Governor Jay Inslee is among the 20 candidates who have qualified for the party's first presidential debates later this month. Montana Governor Steve Bullock and Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts were the only major candidates who failed to meet the polling or grassroots funding required for a debate spot. Some candidates have criticized the debate qualifying rules that party chairman Tom Perez set this year.
People plan to gather at Terry Schrunk Plaza in Portland this Saturday for an impeachment rally from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. That's just one of the demonstrations predicted in more than 100 cities across the country on June 15th, calling for the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Roz Brown takes a look at the organizers of one of the upcoming rallies in New Mexico.
Members of Las Cruces Indivisible will join other groups across the country this Saturday to show their support for Congress to begin impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump. Greg White leads the New Mexico organization and believes findings in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report suggest an impeachment process is appropriate. His group wants New Mexico congressional delegates to know that if they go that route, local residents will have their backs.
We believe that enough time has gone by, that there are enough proven reasons for impeachment to occur, and that it's ethically the right thing to do for the United States.
Nearly 60 House Democrats and one House Republican, Justin Amash of Michigan, have said they support impeachment. That still leaves 158 more needed to impeach, although if that happened, it's likely the GOP-controlled Senate would exonerate the president. White believes that when Mueller spoke publicly last month, he made it clear that it's up to Congress to hold Trump accountable, but adds that voters, Republican, Democrat, Independent, and unaffiliated, deserve a voice in the process.
Regardless of ideology, impeachment and the discussions around it are of such national significance that it must be laid to rest. Congress should act so that it has a basis of fact that it can share with the American public.
White says the Saturday demonstration will include guest speakers who will explain the impeachment process and provide examples of what the community can do if they're in agreement. Some political analysts have warned against pursuing impeachment of the president, claiming the Democratic Party and its 2020 candidates would face a political backlash. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
President Trump again made waves yesterday by saying that he would be willing to violate election law by accepting information on political opponents from foreign governments. This is part of what Trump was accused of doing back in the 2016 election, which he vehemently denied. But now he says he'd be willing to receive dirt on other candidates from foreign governments like Russia, even though that violates the law.
And today, the Office of the Special Counsel publicly called for presidential adviser Kellyanne Conway to be fired from the Trump administration. The office says Conway has repeatedly violated the Hatch Act by disparaging Democratic presidential candidates and others in her official capacity as an employee of the executive branch. The Hatch Act forbids White House employees, except the president and vice president, from engaging in campaign politics. The Office of the Special Counsel wrote that if Conway were any other federal employee, her multiple violations of the law would almost certainly result in removal from her federal position. The 18-page report to Trump says that Conway, who was Trump's campaign chair in 2016, should be removed from her post as counselor to the president for both a slew of TV interviews in 2019, as well as her public attacks on Democrats throughout her Twitter account.
Meantime, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders is leaving her job. President Trump announced the news on Twitter, writing, quote, "After 3.5 years, our wonderful Sarah Huckabee Sanders will be leaving the White House at the end of the month and going home to the great state of Arkansas." Trump went on to say he hopes she will run for governor of Arkansas. The next election for governor of that state is in 2022. Sanders says she's proud to have served the Trump White House, but is looking forward to spending time with her children. Sanders is the second press secretary to leave the Trump administration after Sean Spicer resigned in 2017. Sanders repeatedly defended Trump, following his example to discredit journalists who cover him and admitted to lying to reporters. Her press conferences had grown increasingly rare, especially this year. Her last briefing was in March. She admitted to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team that she lied about the reasons for the firing of former FBI Director James Comey during a 2017 news conference. According to Mueller's final report, Sanders admitted she had no basis for saying that, quote, countless members of the FBI had lost faith in Comey at the time of his firing.
And Congress today took up the issue of deepfakes. Video, photos, and audio that could be altered and weaponized for political purposes. A recent video of U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi edited to make her look drunk is just the beginning. Representative Adam Schiff of California delivered opening remarks this morning before the House Intelligence Committee hearing on deepfakes.
In the heat of the 2016 election, As the Russian hacking and dumping operation became apparent, my predominant concern was that the Russians would begin dumping forged documents along with the real ones that they stole. It would have been all too easy for Russia or another malicious actor to seed forged documents among the authentic ones in a way that would make it almost impossible to identify or rebut the fraudulent material. Even if a victim could ultimately expose the forgery for what it was, the damage would be done. 3 years later, we're on the cusp of a technological revolution that could enable even more sinister forms of deception and disinformation by malign actors, foreign or domestic. Advances in AI and machine learning have led to the emergence of advanced digitally doctored types of media, so-called deep fakes, that enable malicious actors to foment chaos, division, or crisis, and they have the capacity to disrupt entire campaigns, including that for the presidency. Rapid progress in artificial intelligence algorithms has made it possible to manipulate media, video, imagery, audio, text, with incredible, nearly imperceptible results. With sufficient training data, these powerful deepfake generating algorithms can portray a real person doing something they never did or saying words they never uttered. These tools are readily available and accessible to both experts and novices alike, meaning that attribution of a deepfake to a specific author, whether a hostile intelligence service or a single internet troll, will be a constant challenge. What's more, once someone views a deep fake or a fake video, the damage is largely done. Even if later convinced that what they have seen is a forgery, that person may never lose completely the lingering negative impression the video has left with them. It is also the case that not only may fake videos be passed off as real, but real information can be passed off as fake. This is the so-called liar's dividend, in which people with a propensity to deceive are given the benefit of an environment in which it is increasingly difficult for the public to determine what is true. To give our members and the public a sense of the quality of deepfakes today, I want to share a few short examples, and even these are not the state of the art. The first comes from Bloomberg Businessweek and demonstrates an AI-powered clone voice of one of the journalists. So let's watch the
Now, to really put my computer voice to the test, I am going to call my dear, sweet mother and see if she recognizes me.
Hey, Mom.
Hi.
What are you guys up to today?
Well, it's Saturday. We didn't have any electricity early this morning, and we're just hanging around the house.
I'm just finishing up work and waiting for the boys to get home.
Okay.
I think I'm coming down with a virus.
Oh, why, you feel bad, hey?
I was messing around with you. You were talking to a computer.
I felt like I was talking to you. It's amazing.
All right, it's bad enough that was a fake, but he's deceiving his mother and telling her that he's got a virus. That seems just downright cruel. The second clip comes from Quartz and demonstrates a puppet master type of deep fake video. As you can see, these people are able to co-opt the head movements of their targets. If married with convincing audio, you can turn a world leader into a ventriloquist dummy. Next, a brief CNN clip highlighting new research from Professor Haney Farid, an acclaimed expert on deepfakes from UC Berkeley, and featuring an example of a so-called face swap video in which Senator Elizabeth Warren's face is seamlessly transplanted on the body of SNL actress Kate McKinnon.
I haven't been this excited since I found out my package from L.L. Bean had shipped. I'm ready to fight.
So the only problem with that video is Kate McKinnon actually looks a lot like Elizabeth Warren. But the one on the left was actually both were Kate McKinnon. One just had Elizabeth Warren's face swapped onto her. But it shows you just how convincing that kind of technology can be. These algorithms can also learn from pictures of real faces to make completely artificial portraits of persons who do not exist at all. Can anyone here pick out which of these faces are real and which are fake? And of course, as you may have all guessed, all four are fake. All four of those faces are synthetically created. None of those people are real. Thinking ahead to 2020 and beyond, one does not need any great imagination to envision even more nightmarish scenarios that would leave the government, the media, and the public struggling to discern what is real and what is fake. A state-backed actor creates a deepfake video of a political candidate accepting a bribe with the goal of influencing an election. Or an individual hacker claims to have stolen audio of a private conversation between two world leaders when, in fact, no such conversation took place. Or a troll farm uses text-generating algorithms to write false or sensational news stories at scale, flooding social media platforms and overwhelming journalists' ability to verify and users' ability to trust what they are seeing or reading. What enables deepfakes and other modes of disinformation to become truly pernicious is the ubiquity of social media and the velocity at which false information can spread. We got a preview of what that might look like recently when a doctored video of Speaker Nancy Pelosi went viral on Facebook, receiving millions of views in the span of 48 hours. That video was not an AI-assisted deepfake, but rather a crude manual manipulation that some have called a cheap fake. Nonetheless, the video's virality on social media demonstrates the scale of the challenge we face and the responsibilities that social media companies must confront. Already, the companies have taken different approaches, with YouTube deleting the altered video of Speaker Pelosi, while Facebook labeled it as false and throttled back the speed it spread once it was deemed fake by independent fact checkers. Now is the time for social media companies to put in place policies to protect users from this kind of misinformation. Not in 2021, after viral deepfakes have polluted the 2020 elections. By then, it will be too late. And so, in keeping with a series of open hearings that have examined different strategic challenges to our national security and our democratic institutions, the committee is devoting this hearing to deepfakes and synthetic media. We need to soberly understand the implications of deepfakes, the underlying AI technologies, and the internet platforms that give them reach before we consider appropriate steps to mitigate the potential harms.
And we've been listening to the testimony from Adam Schiff opening up the deepfakes hearings that are going on in Capitol Hill today. In Washington state, farm workers are staging a strike. As Eric Tegedoff reports, they say they're upset about what they're calling intimidation and threats.
Workers on a farm in south central Washington state have gone on strike over what they see as threats from management to meet production standards. The laborers on King Fuji Ranch in Mattawa, a small town north of the Tri-Cities area, say they contacted the farm worker union Familias Unidas por la Justicia after repeated threats of firing. The strikers are here on temporary H-2A guest worker visas, which allow foreign workers into the U.S. Edgar Franks with the farm workers' rights group Community to Community Development is in Mattawa and says the men were met with intimidation if they didn't meet production quotas, which they saw as unreasonable.
They were being threatened that if they didn't reach the production standards, that they were going to be put on a list to get taken back to Mexico, or also with the possibility of them not being able to get into the H-2A program again.
Last month, mumps broke out at King Fuji Ranch, leading to the quarantine of more than 100 workers. However, Frank says that hasn't been a big factor in this strike. King Fuji Ranch did not respond to a request for comment by this story's deadline. Frank says Familias Unidas por la Justicia is helping to correct a power imbalance that favors the employer over its workers.
There's still the ability for H-2A workers to be represented and organized, and there's abuses at work, and they're constantly being threatened with deportations or being blacklisted. There's now a union here that can help them exercise their rights as workers.
In May, Governor Jay Inslee signed a bill that provides more oversight for the H-2A program, which has expanded to more than 30,000 workers in Washington state. However, Franks notes that the law doesn't go into effect until August. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And the powerful trucking and logging industries flexed their muscle in the state capitol yesterday in a protest against the proposed cap and trade policies against climate change. Dozens of industrial trucks drove around the Capitol building, blaring their horns and releasing plumes of diesel into the air as part of a demonstration against Oregon's climate policies. The Associated Press reports today that loggers and truckers are pushing back as a key legislative panel sent the proposed cap and trade bill for a full floor vote this week. The cap and trade, plus another bill to reduce diesel emissions from heavy-duty trucks, are meant to reduce the emissions behind global warming and stem the tide of climate change. The program sets aside $10 million every 2 years for investments in transitioning displaced workers to clean energy jobs. There are also wage and labor standards built in to ensure these new jobs offer fair pay and other worker benefits. But truckers and loggers say that there's no reason for the state to move forward with such an ambitious climate platform, since Oregon's emissions make up far less than 1% of the global problem. Workers add that such emissions changes would put them out of business, raising fuel and equipment costs.
More salaried workers in Washington state could get an overtime pay boost. In fact, quite a few of them. KBOO's Nikita Gotham reports this could impact more than a quarter million workers' pay by the year 2026 under a proposed new rule.
Salaried workers in Washington state who log long hours on the job soon could be eligible for overtime pay. The Department of Labor and Industries has proposed raising the threshold for overtime pay for the first time in more than four decades. Currently, any salaried worker making more than $23,660 a year is exempt from overtime pay laws. That threshold is less than the annual pay for someone working a full-time job on the state's minimum wage. Economic Opportunity Institute Policy Director Marilyn Watkins says as the law stands now, bosses can make salaried employees work 50 to 60 hours a week without costing the company any additional money for overtime.
So you're losing out both on income for your family, but also the ability to have some control of your time and the ability to spend time with your family for rest or personal time.
The income threshold would increase at different rates, with a lower threshold for small businesses and a higher one for larger companies, until it reaches nearly $80,000 a year for all employees in 2026. At that time, the new rule would cover more than 250,000 workers. Opponents maintain the measure goes too far and say the state should wait for the federal government's rule on this. The U.S. Department of Labor has proposed increasing the threshold to about $35,300 a year. Watkins says Washington State should be a leader on this and other workers' rights issues and shouldn't revert to the lowest common denominator, especially as the cost of living for families grows. She also notes that increased pay for workers gives them a chance to put more money into the economy, and that overtime was created, in part, so that businesses could expand employment.
Instead of just putting more and more and more work and more hours on their existing workforce, actually, if they had more work to do, going out and hiring another person. So it really was all about job creation, as well as about protecting and building up economic security for working families.
Watkins adds that the current income threshold of about $23,000 also applies to the state's paid sick and safe leave law. An update to this rule would guarantee salaried workers have access to leave. Public comment is open on the overtime rule at the Department of Labor and Industries website through September 6th. For the Public News Service and KBOO News, I'm Nikita Gautam.
Student protests against Portland State Administration and the financial scandal of its recent failed president may have helped persuade the university to cut in half its proposed tuition increase. Or maybe it was new rules by the state. The Portland State University Board of Trustees Finance Committee has decided to lower its proposed tuition increase to 4.9% for the next year. That proposal goes before the full board for approval next week. The board voted last month to approve an up to 11% tuition increase, but its Finance Committee decided to change that after learning they could receive more funding from the state. Meanwhile, students expressed outrage that former PSU President Rahmat Shureshi resigned last month but received more than $800,000 in payouts. A new budget bill from the state's Higher Education Coordinating Commission allots more than $800 million for public universities. That's about $100 million more for those schools than in Governor Kate Brown's original proposed budget. Any tuition increase above 5% requires a review by the Higher Ed Commission.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. So glad you're here with us. Stay tuned after this newscast. Lots of great programming coming up for you tonight. At 6, we've got Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Affable Radio. Tonight's weather, mostly clear skies, down to a low of 55. And for Friday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies, a high of 77. The weekend's looking pretty pleasant with some clouds and sun and in the low 80s. Today in history, on this date in 1979, Sioux Indians were awarded $105 million in compensation for the 1877 U.S. seizure of the Black Hills in South Dakota. And our quote of the day is from one of their heroes, Sitting Bull, who said, "If the Great Spirit had desired me to be a white man, he would have made me so in the first place. He put in your heart certain wishes and plans, and in my heart he put other and different desires. It is not necessary for eagles to be crows."
In Memphis last night, the fatal police shooting of a young black man sparked street protests that lasted through the night and resulted in 23 police being injured. Police shot and killed 20-year-old Brandon Weber after they came to his home with a warrant for his arrest and he attempted to flee in a car. Hundreds of people poured into the streets, breaking windows or of police vehicles and throwing stones and bottles at the police, who showed up in riot gear to break up the protest.
Gunmen in the New Zealand mosque massacres, 28-year-old Australian Brenton Tarrant, pleaded not guilty to all charges when he appeared in court. Previously charged with 50 counts of murder and 39 of attempted murder, Tarrant faced an amended charge of murder following the death of Turkish national Zekeriya Tuyan on May 2nd. Two additional charges of attempted murder and a charge of engaging in a terrorist act under the Terrorism Suppression Act of 2002 developed in the global fallout after the September 11, 2001 attacks. He is the first person to be charged under the country's anti-terrorism legislation. Tarrant appeared by video link from Auckland, New Zealand's only maximum security prison, where he's being held in isolation. Tarrant, in a gray sweatshirt with short cropped hair, was in a small cell with three prison officers in body armor vests who left as the proceedings began. He appeared to smirk as lawyers entered not guilty pleas on his behalf.
And T-Mobile has tried to merge with a competitor three times in the past, but the deals have been blocked each time. Now a group of states are suing, trying to stop a proposed merger with Sprint that they say could especially harm low-income and rural people. Suzanne Potter reports.
The proposed merger between T-Mobile and Sprint hit a big roadblock as state attorneys general from California, New York, and seven other states plus D.C. sued to stop the deal, citing antitrust issues. The two companies provide wireless service to 13 million Californians, including many lower-income families who depend on prepaid plans for internet and cell service. California Attorney General Xavier Becerra says a merger would kill competition in an already tight market.
The new company would have more than 50% of the market share in some parts of our great state, including Los Angeles, but also in places like Imperial County. That combined market share would exceed the threshold at which mergers are presumed to violate antitrust laws.
Currently, four wireless companies dominate the U.S. market: AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon. The lawsuit claims that decreased competition would inevitably lead to higher prices. Becerra said studies done in Europe showed a 16 to 20% average price hike when mergers shrank that market from four major players to three. Sprint and T-Mobile have argued that the merger would allow them to roll out new 5G technology faster and bring it to underserved rural areas. But Becerra says economic analysis by his office shows California consumers would collectively end up paying $4.5 billion more per year.
It would result in significant price increases for Sprint and T-Mobile customers month after month, year after year. And the ripple effect of those price increases could cause even greater harm to the market at large and to customers on other networks.
Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai has indicated support for the merger deal. However, the Justice Department's antitrust division has yet to issue an opinion. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Sunny days are upon us here in the Pacific Northwest, but some parents may be finding it difficult to entice their kids away from those video screens. Dr. Susanna Block, a pediatrician with Kaiser Permanente, notes that too much time in front of a TV, on the phone, or at a computer is linked to a number of health issues, including increased obesity and lower scores on language, cognitive, and social-emotional testing. Without the structure of school during the summer, Block says excessive time in front of video screens tends to creep in. She suggests families devise a media plan to encourage mindful media use and write it down for everyone to see.
It's very helpful to build in screen-free time. So that could be at dinner or maybe after a certain hour at night. We just say, this is a screen-free time. There are no screens. Some families put their screens away in the evening so they can just engage with each other without screens. The bottom line is digital media is here to stay, and this is where we do a lot of our learning, a lot of our communicating, and a lot of our research. So helping our kids learn how to be good digital citizens early and using their media thoughtfully will help them lifelong.
And Dr. Block says media plans will vary depending on children's ages. She suggests screens should be out of the bedroom at night so they don't disrupt sleep, and that families come up with alternatives to screen time, such as going outside or doing a project. As children get older, the dangers from too much screen time change. Block says about 8% of children ages 8 to 18 have internet gaming disorder. That's an addiction to playing video or internet games. Children at these ages are also more likely to be exposed to inappropriate content and cyberbullying. The doctor suggests people look at the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines on screen time. The association recommends no screen time for children younger than 2. For 2 to 5-year-olds, it suggests no more than an hour a day and no more than 2 hours for school-aged children and teenagers. Block says it's also important for parents to evaluate their own time in front of those screens.
Trump administration officials rushed to blame Iran for the reported attacks on 2 oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman today. But the timing and apparent target of the explosions prompted warnings from Iranian analysts that they may have been part of a deliberate effort to provoke a war between the U.S. and Iran. The National Iranian American Council issued a statement that because the sabotage occurred amid Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's state visit to Iran, the likely motive of the attackers is to increase the tension between the U.S. and Iran. As Common Dreams reported last month, the recent escalation between Iran and the U.S. was sparked by the Trump administration's threats and naval activity in the Persian Gulf.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Chairman Harold Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota says vehicles or personnel working on the Keystone XL pipeline are not welcome on the reservation. Tribal police escorted trucks off the reservation this week they believe were associated with the pipeline after grassroots groups stopped vehicles. A tribal resolution requires Keystone XL vehicles which drive onto the reservation to be turned around immediately. Frazier says the tribe will not stand for encroachment or defilement on Sioux territory. The tribe opposes the pipeline, concerned about impacts to land and water. Meanwhile, Native groups plan to join environmental groups in Rapid City to rally against South Dakota's riot-boosting law. It was passed at the end of the 2019 legislative session. The legislation is the subject of a hearing to be held Wednesday at the federal courthouse in Rapid City. At the request of Governor Kristi Noem, lawmakers pushed the bill through to address protests against the Keystone XL pipeline. It holds protest supporters civilly and criminally liable if a riot breaks out. Several groups sued in federal court to stop that law from going into effect. One of them is the Sierra Club, whose South Dakota chairman traveled to Rapid City for the hearing. Mark Winiger says the wording of the law is too broad.
You know, it's not just that the Sierra Club could get sued or that Dakota Rural Action could get sued. Your grandmother could get sued. You know, your uncle, your daughter, anybody who talks about these problems enough that it inspires somebody to go march or demonstrate against them. So we're all in this together.
Other plaintiffs are Indian Collective, Dakota Rural Action, Black Hills Clean Water Alliance, and Indigenous Environmental Network, all represented by the ACLU. The groups plan to march to the federal courthouse to rally. A long-awaited road has breathed new life into a First Nations community on the border between Manitoba and Ontario. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it could also end one of the longest boil water advisories in the country.
They call it Freedom Road. The 15-mile stretch of gravel road will make it easier for people living in the community of Shoal Lake 40 to finally access clean tap water. The reserve was cut off when an aqueduct was built to supply water to Winnipeg. Since then, residents of Shoal Lake 40 have had to use boats in the summer, and winter roads cut through the ice just to supply basic needs. A long list of chiefs had fought for a road to end the hardship. $30 million in funding was needed. An agreement was finally reached in 2016, and the goal was recently achieved, and people celebrated to mark the opening of a link to the Trans-Canada Highway and the rest of Canada. Former Chief Herb Redsky was there.
I want to acknowledge and say thank you to the City of Winnipeg, the province of Manitoba, and the federal government for having the courage to do the right thing.
For others, it means a new beginning and growth for the community. The road will also bring the materials needed to build new homes and a new school. And Indigenous Affairs Minister Seamus O'Regan also said work can now begin on a new water treatment facility to end a boil water advisory that's lasted decades. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Funeral services were held Tuesday for a Seminole Tribe of Florida leader. As leader of the tribe in the late 1960s and early 70s, Joe Dan Osceola is credited with healthcare improvements and boosting economic development. He was also the first president of the organization United South and Eastern Tribes. In recent years, he served as an ambassador for the Seminole Tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Hackers tried to ransom unpublished music by the British superband Radiohead. Instead of paying the hackers $150,000, Radiohead released all the music on Bandcamp as a benefit for the Extinction Rebellion movement. According to a statement that was released by the band earlier this week, 18 hours of unreleased content were stolen from their musical archive. Radiohead guitarist and composer Johnny Greenwood said, quote, "Instead of complaining much or ignoring it, we're releasing all 18 hours on Bandcamp in aid of Extinction Rebellion for the next 18 days. So for £18, you can find out if we should have paid that ransom."
Here's your chance to learn more about different Latino cultures while enjoying food, dancing, and singing at Festival Latino. It's coming up June 22nd at Clackamas Community College in Oregon City. The festival runs from noon to 4 p.m., and it includes a DJ, student speakers, Zumba, traditional indigenous Latino singing, and traditional Mexican dance performances. There will also be face painting, door prizes, campus tours, and low-cost Mexican food. Some resources will be on site, including Clackamas Social Services Workforce, Clackamas County Children's Commission Head Start and Early Head Start, Providence Willamette Falls Medical Center, Clackamas County Libraries, Immigrant and Refugee Community Organizations, Job Corps, Oregon Youth Authority, and the Unidos Club. Community colleges representatives will have information on English as a second language, general education development, and adult basic education courses. Community partners will have information about small business development, immigrant and refugee support, and family services. This event is free and open to the community.
And finally, back in England, the UK Home Secretary announced he's signed a request for Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States. KBOO's Emery Mort has more in this commentary.
This formal step means Assange's extradition request will proceed into the UK courts, as expected, in a process that could take many months to play out, assuming Assange survives his detention. The first court hearing is expected to be tomorrow, Friday, the 14th of June, and Assange, whose physical and mental health are collapsing under isolation and torture, will only attend via video, if at all. Assange is currently in high-security prison in the UK and has lived through torture, according to a UN expert on international law who carefully studied the situation. Assange, an Australian national, is being punished by several Western democracies in tandem, the US, UK, Sweden, and Australia, for multiple charges, but mainly publishing information that gives insight into how the US conducts its many wars and wields its powers. He now faces 18 charges in the US, including some under the Espionage Act. While many major media outlets have published stories based on the documents, memos, cables, and videos WikiLeaks published with the help of whistleblowers, Assange has been vilified by the proper journalists because of his personality and his opposition to liberal war hawks like Hillary Clinton. This liberal elite vilification served as social justification for the U.S. government to take extremely aggressive steps to punish Assange. Analysts suggest Assange will be far from the only victim of these indictments, as the indictments alone will make even major newspapers squirm before publishing information on U.S. torture, war crimes, lies, and other crimes committed in illegal U.S. wars of aggression. The U.S. has made clear none of its leaders who start wars that kill millions of people will ever face any punishment, an effort that is made easier if the public never sees the videos and memos that make the crimes obvious. Returning to the U.K., its government is in shambles, and it may have to look to the U.S. for a sweet trade deal, thanks to Brexit and the mess the political right and center have created in the country. The U.S. has enormous leverage over the right-wing U.K. government, given this need. But Assange may be saved by the UK courts, who may rule that, by law, his extradition, given such outrageous charges, would be political in nature. Thanks to British conservative Sajid Javid, the first step in that court drama will commence tomorrow. For KBOO News, this is Emery Mort.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 13th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. So call us with your breaking news stories and tips. Here's the number, 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ron Bede, Nikita Gotham, and Emery Mort. The producer is myself, Annette Newell, and our engineer is Randall Rigo. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Sojourner Truth looks at the protests in Haiti and Honduras. At 9, the beloved community host John Shuck speaks live with filmmaker Massimo Mazzucco about his latest documentary, American Moon. At 10, Patricia Welch talks to the Vancouver NAACP about their upcoming Juneteenth celebration. At 10:30, Film at 11 welcomes Just Jess of the Monday Sampler to discuss some recent Netflix movies, including Unicorn Store and Rim of the World. And at 11 on The Digital Divide, host Rabia Yeaman speaks with author George Dyson about his book, Turing's Cathedral, the story of how the most constructive and most destructive of 20th century inventions, the digital computer and the hydrogen bomb, emerged at the same time. Don't forget, you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Don't forget to become a KBOO member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Tomorrow at noon, Extinction Rebellion PDX is calling a demonstration at City Hall. The group is pushing back against the City of Portland's stance allowing Zenith Energy to enlarge its oil terminal despite a city resolution to limit fossil fuel infrastructure. Tonight, we are broadcasting an encore interview with Ken Ward and Mia Reback, conducted by KBOO's Barbara Bernstein, explaining the issues and the group's strategies for holding the city accountable. This interview was originally aired in April of this year.
Last year, Zenith Energy in Northwest Portland quietly began exporting tar sands oil from its Willamette River facility. Now Zenith Energy is expanding the facility so that it can handle more than three times the number of oil trains that currently pass through the city. For the past two Sundays, a group of folks from Extinction Rebellion took over the tracks at Zenith Energy in the industrial zone of Northwest Portland, dumping a truck full of soil over the train tracks and planting a victory over fossil fuels garden, complete with sheds, scarecrows, and a real growing garden. Last week, 11 people were arrested. Yesterday, 14 more. Today, we talk with Mia Reback, lobbyist with the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, about why climate activists are taking direct action against Zenith Energy. We also have with us two of the track sitters, Jan Zuckerman and Ken Ward, who is of valve turner fame. Mia and Jan, welcome to Locus Focus. Welcome back. And Ken, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
So let's first start talking about this group, Extinction Rebellion, which until a few weeks ago, nobody had ever heard of. And then suddenly the streets of London were filled with people stopping traffic, putting large ships in the middle of Oxford Circus, and otherwise completely shutting down the city. So how is this an inspiration for what you guys are doing?
Well, the mass amount of folks out on the street demanding the truth, demanding the taking down of the emissions, lowering emissions. I mean, really getting the word out and taking action was really inspiring. Thousands and thousands of people of all ages.
You're talking about in London?
Yeah, in London.
So that's what inspired you to start working? Because I know, I want to get Mia in here, who was the original person. We're going to be talking about this in a very theoretical way, Mia, when we first planned this show, coming out of the community forums that you helped organize. And then last Sunday, sort of the temper and the temperature raised quite a bit. So I want to first step back a little bit and talk about what this facility is that Zenith's doing and why people are up in arms about it. And then we'll kind of get into how people are organizing besides sitting on tracks. So first of all, what's going on with Zenith Energy? Who are they and how did they get there?
Yeah, Zenith Energy is a new company that about less than 2 years ago bought an existing fossil fuel terminal in Northwest Portland and rapidly converted it into a tar sands export facility. And I think so many people are outraged about this because Portland has a long history of climate and environmental activism and city and political action as well. So we have this history of movements and people taking direct action from Shell No and this long record of when the community mobilizes, people win. And so people know that direct action is a viable tactic. But people have also been engaging for years, going to City Hall, engaging with the legislature, and in at least the city and county level, passing meaningful policies that commit the city and county to moving off of fossil fuels and completely transitioning to 100% renewable energy. So while the city has all of these great commitments to stop fossil fuels and change our energy system to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in line with our climate action plan and what 97-99% of scientists are saying we must do. Meanwhile, this fossil fuel company buys a not really operational oil terminal in Portland. It was referred to as a ghost town and a fixer-upper. And they buy this facility and immediately in their first 6 months of operation are exporting tar sands crude out of Portland. And tar sands is the dirtiest form of fossil fuel. It's the most environmentally destructive at the point of extraction and from burning it. And it's also really, really dangerous to transport it and store it in our community. So we as residents of Portland are exposed to this huge amount of risk, and this company is making a lot of money off of it.
So I guess the question is, how did this happen? I mean, they bought this property, and there's a permit attached to it. Is that true?
Exactly. So the previous company was called Arc Logistics. And in 2014, when Arc Logistics bought the not really operational, not doing very much fossil fuel terminal, they applied for permits to expand the rail unloading capacity. And it's important to distinguish very specifically what they're doing. They're not building more storage capacity, more storage tanks. They're increasing their ability to unload oil, which means they can process and move more oil quickly. So while we know that their permits say that they can quadruple their rail unloading capacity, they could actually potentially be moving more than four times the amount of oil they're moving right now. This isn't a limit on how much oil they can move. It has to do with how quickly they can unload the rail cars.
So it sounds like the infrastructure ban for any future fossil fuel development in Portland didn't envision this scenario.
It was known at the time that this issue of throughput, which is how much fossil fuel is moved, was something unaddressed in the policy. So the policy dealing with infrastructure has to do with what gets built. But because these are permits filed in 2014, and the city's policies to oppose fossil fuels were passed in 2015 and 2016, they don't apply to these previously existing permits. But what's so incredibly frustrating is we're dealing with a different company. Zenith Energy bought the terminal in December of 2017, inherited old permits, and we don't actually know as the public if this is what ARC Logistics was planning to do, we know that they were planning to move volatile hazardous substances. That is in their permits. But there's such a range of crude oil and toxic chemicals that get added to different types of crude oil that we as the public and our regulators, quite frankly, were left in the dark about what is actually happening.
So I guess the question and why Jan and Ken here have been sitting on railroad tracks is, does the city have any ability to stop this? And if they don't, what steps do we take? So first of all, I know that Joanne Hardesty's staff people were at the tracks a week ago, and I heard them speak and was very frustrated with what they were saying, as yeah. were Ken and Jan.
They said they had their hands tied, pretty much.
Yeah. And I actually was trying to get Joanne on the show today, but she's busy, so she can't be on, and I'm hoping to get her to talk, because I'd really like to know from herself and not from her staff. I mean, in the same week, she signed a no fossil fuel campaign dollars pledge, and she crossed that the $200 limit and crossed it none at all. And I also think she's come out in support of, I mean, she's very much against what Zenith is doing, but she's also, I got the feeling, in support of what the protesters are doing. But I think we all hoped when Joanne was elected that she was going to be the magic superwoman, our superhero, and change everything, and it doesn't work that way. So I guess I wanted to get a sense of, is anybody talking to the city and knowing what they are really trying to do?
Yeah, so many organizations, including the Center for Sustainable Economy, the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, and many other environmental and conservation groups, are talking to the city. And recently, a coalition of organizations sent a sign-on letter to the city of Portland asking for a series of actions to be taken, the first of which being a moratorium on all permits relating to fossil fuel terminals. So a question to be asked is, has Zenith received all of their permits? And according to a website called Portland Maps that makes a lot of information publicly available, you can go on this website and type in the address of the facility, 5501 Northwest Front Avenue, and it says that they still have one permit that they have not yet received. It's for a fence, so it's not the most direct fossil fuel hook, but at the same time, you know, we can call on the city to not grant any more permits until a thorough review has happened. So there still hasn't been a public hearing. There's been no health and safety review. And while Zenith says that they're improving their safety at the terminal site, the majority of the risk that Portlanders face is along the rail line. And it has to do with the transport of toxic crude along rails that are prone to derailment. And so, you know, that's an opportunity, we think, for the city to thoroughly investigate every single permitting angle, large or small, and not grant any permits until Zenith shows up to a public hearing and publicly discloses what they're doing, allows for health and safety review, and actually conducts spill tests and demonstrates that they can respond to an accident.
I'm getting two deja vus as I'm listening to you talk. One of them is Pembina, which was defeated almost 4 years ago, I guess, somewhere in there. And that was about a pipeline that was how long, like 20 feet or something? It was just a tiny pipeline, and it was going to go through a sensitive environmental area, and so it needed to get an exemption, and it didn't get it through a lot of very strong grassroots activity. So that's the positive one. So that fence is giving me hope, Mia, and I hope that fence can stop this from happening. The other deja vu I'm getting is this very large LNG tank. It holds 800 million gallons of LNG, or will, in Tacoma, which was built without permits. And I was talking with Jan last week, and I said, you sort of exclaimed, we're not Tacoma, or are we? So that's my question is, is there a difference between what Portland has put in place and the politics, the local and county politics here? Is there a difference between what is happening here and what happens in a place like Tacoma, where all this stuff is just pushed under the carpet and Puget Sound Energy just is allowed to build a facility without any permits? Because I remember talking to Jan the other day, and she was saying that if she tried to make a change, if she was doing a renovation in a house and she tried to change something that she had a permit for without going through and getting the permit updated, they wouldn't let her do it, which is what people in Tacoma argue about this tank that's being built. So What is the hope of that we are not Tacoma and that we can actually stop this thing?
And I think it goes to this idea of sacrifice zones and environmental sacrifice zones and places where the industry and government have deemed already so polluted and almost take this attitude of, well, why not build something else? Like, it's already gross here. And I think that's what's so inspiring about what the folks with Extinction Rebellion were putting forward with their actions is this alternate vision, this ultimate dream of what will it look like to dismantle the fossil fuel industry, move away from dirty infrastructure, and actually clean up and reclaim these spaces and return them and restore them to something that people and animals can use and be in safely. And so I think of, you know, Tacoma and these industrial areas and the Northwest, Portland, you know, fossil fuel terminal hub have these similarities in that they are longtime industrial areas that are deeply, deeply polluted with, you know, long histories of very wealthy industries there. And yet it is time for everything to change. Everything we have taken for granted, we need to reassess in light of climate change. And we can move off of fossil fuels and we can really bring about this deeper, more beautiful vision of what our spaces can look like. But it's going to take a groundswell of people and activism in every single sphere to stop this project. And so we absolutely need our elected officials at the city and the county doing everything they can, evaluating every permitting opportunity, every safety review, everything that they can do. We need the state legislature in Oregon to pass legislature to regulate rail cars. But we also need people, everyday people, to rise up and to recognize that this construction is already happening. They're not waiting for a public hearing. The company is moving ahead. And so it really is up to people and groups like Extinction Rebellion to step in that sphere of everyday people and everyday action.
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking
about... That was more eloquent than we were planning to do.
Mia's great.
Thanks, Mia.
Very short things, which is in terms of what...
This is Ken Ward you're hearing right now.
You know, to go back to your first question, the appeal to me of Extinction Rebellion, other than that the first action I saw them do was to sit down in Greenpeace office in London and demand that Greenpeace, start taking more direct action, which was very appealing to me as a former Greenpeace staff person. But it is to say we don't have, you know, we're now at a point where we can't any longer spend our time trying to calculate what's possible within politics as usual, which is essentially what most of us have been doing for decades, and that's because that's the limits of what was available to us. We have to instead be saying, what is it that's necessary, geophysically necessary, to kind of avoid the very worst here? And that's what we have to bring to our government. So our call, in the Zenith situation, is to say to our city and county and state government, this should be no burning of tar sands oil anywhere. That's absolutely clear. The first thing you would do if you were an intelligent government or species would be to shut down all burning of coal and tar sands oil. And that's what the city should be doing. And they have the tools to do that, which we pointed out in an accompanying letter, that they have zoning authority. They could simply rezone the area from industrial to open space. And because we don't have time and because we want to force them to pay attention to this, that's what we're using direct action to do, to just go out there, stop the trains, which we did for 2 days and that, 2.5 days now, by planting a garden on the tracks. Yesterday, we actually planted an auxiliary garden, a little flower garden, over where they were building infrastructure, where they're rebuilding this train tracks. This is what our government should be doing. We should be shutting that down and returning it to open space with farms and carbon, storing forests.
It wasn't too long ago that the mayor said we have to take deliberate steps to meet our 100% renewable energy goals. And what are deliberate steps? And that's what I'm asking the city. We're taking deliberate steps, but they have to be taken immediately.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:57. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall in Vancouver, Washington. The theme of the 7th annual Juneteenth celebration is Together We Rise. This theme addresses the idea that together we rise above the fray of hatred, despair, and discord. The celebration features a job fair, panels, awards, contests, an art gallery, live entertainment, and more. Again, that's the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, June 17th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen But I'm a Cheerleader. In 1999, romantic comedy where a high school cheerleader is sent to the residential inpatient conversion therapy camp to cure her lesbianism. The screening benefits the Q Center. Again, that's I'm a Cheerleader, showing Monday, June 17th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to a digital Indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native Radio.
Can you tell an Indian first then?
Hello, hello out there. You're listening to Rose City Native Radio. I'm your host, Jack Malmstrom. We got a show for you today on this hot, hot summer day. I am loving it. I know some of you aren't, but it's okay. It's okay to be wrong. I'm just kidding. I love you all. This desert Indian is very, very happy with the heat. I just hope our state doesn't catch fire. But it's cooling down for everybody. So I hope you enjoy the sun. I hope you get some AC when you can. We have some hot stuff for you today. We have an interview with Rosalinda and Frank, friends of the show, coming on soon, and music and Super Indian coming up later in the show. Starting off, we have Wolf Saga with Stolen here on Rose City Native Radio, KBOO Portland.